This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. Two women were pulled from the rubble in southern Turkey, and a mother and two children were rescued from the city of Antakya on Wednesday as rescue efforts shifts to getting relief to survivors 9 days after the deadly earthquake. The combined death toll in Turkey and Syria has climbed to more than 41,000, and millions are in need of humanitarian aid, with many survivors having been left homeless in near-freezing winter temperatures. Rescues are now few and far between. Last week's disastrous earthquake has shaken the political fortunes of the leaders in Turkey and Syria. Analysts warn of normalization in Syria and possible re-election trouble in Turkey. For VOA, Dave Gavlak reports from Amman.
More than a decade of conflict and blocked borders to aid deliveries have hampered access to the rubble-held area of northwest Syria, decimated by the powerful quake from the nearby Turkish epicenter. Turkey has received the lion's share of international assistance to date. The Norwegian Refugee Council and 35 other non-governmental organizations are demanding increased support for Syria's affected areas. Meanwhile, analysts say Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has come under fire for his government's reaction to the earthquake, as the death toll rises in the southwest and affects his chances of re-election. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Wednesday Ukraine's victory must truly be felt this spring as NATO announced ramped-up military equipment promises. He said, we have to ensure that this spring it is truly felt that Ukraine is moving towards victory. In his nightly address, NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said alliance members were continuing to produce artillery rounds. This is VOA News. El Salvador's state of emergency to combat gangs will be maintained until all criminals are captured, the country's security minister told Reuters. Correspondent Angela Johnston reports.
El Salvador's state of emergency to combat gangs has led to tens of thousands of arrests and allegations of human rights abuses. But it also appears to be massively popular. And in a recent interview, the country's security minister, Gustavo Villatoro, said the measure will stay in place until every criminal is caught. President Nayib Bukele asked Congress to approve the state of emergency last March. Since then, security forces have arrested more than 64,000 suspected gang members or associates.
Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston. U.S. President Joe Biden says policies from the opposition Republican Party would blow up the national debt, the AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Speaking near Washington, the president said Republicans say their priority is balancing the budget.
But their plans are going to increase the deficit by $3 trillion based on what they introduced so far.
The president said he would release his budget March 9th, which would protect Social Security and Medicare from cuts. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy says no more blank checks for runaway government spending. They must also reach a deal by midsummer on raising the government's legal borrowing authority, or else the government could lack the funds to pay its bills and default. Ed Donahue, Washington.
U.S. actress Raquel Welch has died after a brief illness, according to her agent. Welch was 82, AP correspondent Margie Zarletta reports.
Raquel Welch had all of three lines in the film 1 Million Years B.C., but it made her a star, primarily because of the animal skin bikini she wore in it. Welch told reporters in 2001 it was hard to overcome being a sex symbol.
It's not all that much fun. As I was coming up to 40, I was looking for breadcrumbs along the road of sex symboldom, you know. Okay, now what do I do next? And I couldn't find any that were very positive.
While Welch appeared in other lusty roles, she also won acclaim for her performances in The Three Musketeers, in the James Coco film Wild Party, and in the TV movie Right to Die. I'm Archie Zarletta.
Recovery efforts continue in New Zealand Thursday after a cyclone caused havoc across the North Island, leaving at least five people dead, displacing 9,000 and causing significant damage. The cyclone, which reached New Zealand on Sunday before making its way down the east coast of the North Island, cut off entire towns, washed away farms, bridges, and livestock, and inundated homes, stranding people on rooftops. Communication and access to several areas remains difficult, and surveillance flights are being undertaken to see what's happened and identify those who may be isolated. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Thank you. Today is Thursday, February 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the U.S. and NATO recommits more weapons and training to Ukraine as it readies for offensive against Russian forces.
Members of the U.S.-led Ukraine Contact Group met in Brussels, with Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin making clear that Ukraine is not alone in its fight against Russia's invasion.
Shock as Scottish leader suddenly resigns after 8 years in the job.
I know that time is now, that it is right for me, for my party, and for the country. And so today I am announcing my intention to step down as First Minister and leader of my party.
And dozens of migrants reported missing and presumed dead following a shipwreck off the Libyan coast. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said on Wednesday that allies will send new support to Ukraine, including heavy weapons and military training. This as U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says 54 members of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group are focused on providing Kyiv with the ammunition, fuel and spare parts they will need for an expected spring offensive. VOA's senior diplomatic correspondent Sidney Sain reports.
Members of the U.S.-led Ukraine Contact Group met in Brussels, with Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin making clear that Ukraine is not alone in its fight against Russia's invasion. Asked where things stand, Austin had this to say.
What Ukraine wants to do in the first possible moment is to establish or create momentum and establish conditions on the battlefield that continue to be in its favor. And so we expect to see them conduct an offensive sometime in the spring.
Austin said the 54 countries represented in the group will do everything they can to keep the ammunition and arms Kyiv needs flowing as Russia ramps up its attacks. The Russian Defense Ministry released images saying they show artillery and air defense units operating in Ukraine. The U.S. Defense Secretary said Russia is sending large numbers of new troops into Ukraine, but many are ill-equipped and ill-trained. Chairman of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, noted Russia continues to push forward in Ukraine's Donbas region.
Well, they are attacking in the Donbas right now. Their progress is slow. It's a war of attrition. They're taking heavy casualties. Their leadership and morale is not great, and they're struggling mightily. However, they do have numbers.
A Russian army spokesman said what he called volunteer assault units, with the support of missile and artillery forces, have captured a village just north of Bakhmut. Ukraine has conceded the situation is difficult around the embattled eastern city. Ukraine has asked for Western fighter jets to defend itself, but Austin said he had nothing to announce on that. He added the U.S. has not prevented Poland or any other country from providing its own aircraft, noting the decision would be up to each individual nation. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
A full year of daily strikes on civilian areas of Ukraine have left people numb, saying they barely hear the sirens. Even far from the front lines, locals say everything about life in Ukraine is different. VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Dnipro in Ukraine.
Sirens have howled across Ukraine almost every day for a year, indicating a strike may land somewhere, and it would be a good idea to go inside, or underground if possible. Most of the time, people ignore the noise. The sirens were on when a missile hit this apartment building in Dnipro, according to local soldiers, but some survivors say they don't remember hearing it. The missile ripped into the building on a holiday in January, killing 45 people. Dnipro is far from the front lines and now home to thousands of displaced families. But it is still often the target of Russian bombs. Locals say a year of war has changed everything about their lives. While war rages on in the eastern part of the country, other major cities, like Lviv in the west, have transformed. The hospital has become a national trauma center, accepting patients who have lost limbs in battles across the country. And in Dnipro, which is in central Ukraine, survivors say the grief and the terror of the war reaches them daily, if not the actual battles. Officials say in a year of battle, more than 7,100 civilians have been killed and more than 40,000 buildings have been destroyed in Ukraine. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Dnipro, Ukraine.
Thank you, Heather. And Iran has notified the United Nations that its Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian will travel to Geneva to address the annual opening session of the world's body's Human Rights Council on February 27th. He will make the address as Tehran has been facing international criticism and condemnation for its deadly crackdown on peaceful nationwide protests that began last September against Iran's Islamist rulers. For a preview of what to expect from Amir Abdullahian's speech, correspondent Lisa Schlein spoke to Michael Lippin on the phone from Geneva.
Typically what happens is the meeting, when it opens on February 27th, there will be opening speeches by the president of the General Assembly. He will be followed by Switzerland as the host country. And from what I've been told is there are six heads of state that actually will be speaking at the beginning of the session. And then it's all the other countries who have asked to appear that will be there. Now, from what I've learned, Amir Abdullahian will be speaking in the afternoon. And interestingly, he will be wedged between Norway and Sweden. His speech will be coming between two very liberal Western governments. And what they have to say is up to them. They will present their positions, I think, regarding what they consider to be some of the priorities that they want to see advanced at the Human Rights Council. And possibly, since they will know that Iran will be there, they may have something to say in regard to the situation there. But I'm not a prophet, so I can't speak about that.
That's definitely something to keep an eye on. So have you heard anything about what Western nations like Norway and Sweden and even the United States might do in response to Amir Abdullahian's participation in this session? And for that matter, what rights activists who are very critical of Iran might do when he shows up and gives his speech?
Well, no actions are going to be taken at the opening session because that's just for countries to speak and to set their priorities. Actions will come later on during the session, which is interesting. Now, what might happen on that first day is that the minister will actually be there in person. You know, he will be giving his speech from the floor. And because of COVID, practically nobody ever appeared in the past 2 years at the Human Rights Council. And it seems as if everybody is kind of eager to jump out of their cocoon. And so there's going to be a crowd, a massive of people who are actually going to be attending this session for the first time in the past 2 or 3 years. Now, what might happen, and again, I don't know, but surely there's a big Iranian lobby here in Geneva, people who are very critical of what's happening in Iran. They will know that he will be here. And so quite possibly there may be some kind of a protest, a demonstration, which may occur in front of the UN, the Palais de Nation, the headquarters here, in order to voice their grievances. That could happen.
That's correspondent Lisa Schlein speaking with Michael Lippin from Geneva. Scottish leader Nicola Sturgeon says she is resigning after 8 years in the job. Associated Press correspondent Charles de la Desma reports.
Sturgeon tells the media that part of serving in politics is knowing when it's time to make way for someone else.
In my head and in my heart, I know that time is now. That it is right for me, for my party, and for the country. And so today I am announcing my intention to step down as First Minister and leader of my party.
The First Minister adds she'd wrestled with the decision, but that the pressure of the job was relentless and that she's a human being as well as a politician.
Giving absolutely everything of yourself to this job is the only way to do it. The country deserves nothing less.
Meanwhile, the BBC reports Sturgeon's faced months of controversy over a law that makes it simpler for people to change their gender on official documents. I'm Charles de la Desma.
And Kenya's security forces have launched an operation to clear bandits from its northern Rift Valley region and recover illegal firearms. Critics have voiced concern that the operation led by army-backed police could lead to abuses. Mohamed Yusuf reports from Nairobi, Kenya.
President William Ruto issued the order after three police officers were killed and eight other injured in an ambush in Kainuk, Turkana County. Bandits have attacked communities in the country's northern region for decades, with stolen livestock blamed for most of the conflict. Kenya's police chief, Japhet Koome, urged communities to stop attacking each other after visiting Turkana County Tuesday.
People of this region have no option. They must learn to coexist. This habit of one community attacking the other one will not be allowed to continue. We have the capacity and the will.
Ahmed Mohamed, the head of the Center for Security and Strategic Studies, says the bandits are interested in stealing animals.
They cannot face any formidable force, whether it is police or military. In fact, right now, they're gone. Gone where? They're in towns. Not in the jungles you're fighting there. They've gone. They'll not face you. You'll see them. You'll be alone there for a while. You'll run around. You look for weapons. You'll force people. You will, do your own thing. But right now, they're not there. They're not there. They're in towns, back in their normal activities.
The government has given the bandits 3 days to surrender their weapons. Last week, suspected bandits sprayed bullets into a vehicle carrying passengers, killing three people, including a student, in Turkana County. Drought, according to Pokot South MP David Kosing, is to blame for the current tensions and conflict between his community and the Turkana tribe.
There's no order of grazing or let's say, drinking water. And therefore, the Pokot can push themselves to the river. And maybe this river is on the side in terms of administration of Turkana, and the Turkanas feel that they are being intimidated, or they think that Pokots are coming to their own land, and vice versa. And that is the reason why there is a lot of conflict, is the competition for grass, which is now very high along that area.
The conflict over pastures and water for the animals has heightened tensions in the area and halted other civilian and government activities. Kenya is one of the countries in the region that is currently affected by the drought. Drought has affected 23 counties, including Baringo, Laikipia, Samburu, West Pokot and Turkana. Mohamed says the government will need to provide more resources and development in the affected region to stop animal theft.
Those communities have lost a lot of animals, They have gone down in terms of numbers, and therefore, when they see others who are doing well, they'll definitely go for them, definitely. So the drought, climate change, definitely has had an impact. So that's why we're saying also, as part of the future plans, the government must think about development, think about life beyond livestock and all that, other means that can be used to help the people sustain their lives.
Kosing fears the security operation may bring more problems for his people than good.
Out of 16 divisions in West Bogot, 3 are in distress. So sometimes when you unleash oppression, then they can actually even make everybody a criminal. The past has been that it's criminalizing society, and that's my fear. Number two, that there's been incidences of rape in the past. There are incidences of hunger, roadblocks. You might remember some few months ago, there were roadblocks in Tiati, and people almost died. 16 schools were closed in Tiati.
The operation will also include the recovery of stolen livestock and patrolling major roads to ensure the free movement of people and goods. Mohamed Yusuf for VA News, Nairobi.
In other news, the official Twitter account of the International Organization for Migration, IOM, in Libya, says at least 73 migrants were reported missing and presumed dead following a shipwreck off the Libyan coast on Tuesday. 7 survivors made it to shore from the boat, which was carrying around 80 people, who had reportedly departed from Kassel Al-Kaya, east of Tripoli, to head to Europe. The IOM says so far 11 bodies have been retrieved by the Libyan Red Crescent and the local police, while the 7 survivors are in hospital. Libya has become a major launching point for migrants seeking to reach Europe via a dangerous route across the desert and over the Mediterranean. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Afo in Washington. Nigeria's Department of State Services, DSS, has warned politicians not to publish false or harmful information in the run-up to next week's presidential election. The warning came after the ruling All Progressives Congress Party's campaign director accused the military and opposition candidate of plotting a coup. Fact-checkers are working overtime to debunk false news ahead of the February 25th elections, as Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja, Nigeria.
The notice to politicians was contained in a statement Tuesday. The Department of State Services said political parties and their media managers must restrain from spreading misleading information during campaigns and when issuing communiques. The DSS said such information could lead to violent reactions and disrupt peace and order. The warning comes in the wake of the agency's investigation of the campaign director of the ruling All Progressives Congress, APC. Femi Fani-Kayode alleged on Twitter that the opposition People's Democratic Party presidential candidate Atiku Abubakar was planning a coup d'etat. The DSS interrogated Fani-Kayode Wednesday. VOA could not immediately get comments from the service on the investigation. Paul James, an elections program officer at Yaga Africa, a non-profit organization promoting democracy, says slander among political parties is not new.
The DSS is investigating that and have called the person in for questioning. So we hope to see how that will end. From the Edo election in 2020, Ondo election in 2020, we saw things like this. The military had come out to actually deny that. But not just that. They need to begin to do things, the kind of communication that will also inspire confidence.
Fani-Kayode will report to the DSS every week until the investigation is over. On Monday, he spoke to journalists in Abuja after being interrogated for 5 hours and said he regretted posting the tweet without confirmation from authorities. Nigeria is seeing a heightened spread of fake news and disinformation in a push for votes ahead of the elections. The country goes to the polls on February 25th to elect a new president with three candidates as front runners. A Nigerian Fact Checkers coalition made up of 14 newsrooms is working to curb the spread of falsehoods. But the coalition's Kemi Busari says it is more challenging to keep up with the trend of misinformation these days.
What we notice currently is a proliferation of false information, especially about the election. We also see a lot of false information about the electoral process. We get a lot of, like I said, we get a lot more these days, a lot more false information these days. Before, I could say the average copies that come to my desk each day is about 2 to 5. But now we are having nothing less than 10 to 15 copies in a day. And of course, it's not possible for us to fact check everything.
Busari says the Fact Checkers Coalition is setting up centers in Lagos and Abuja to monitor the elections and information about the voting in real time. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Ethiopia has long struggled with problems of communal friction turning into violent ethnic conflicts. Members of the two largest ethnic groups, the Oromos and Amharas, have come together to showcase traditional conflict resolution through musical drama. Mayam Makeo reports from Adama, Ethiopia.
1 year ago, Bertukan Taddese was fleeing war between Ethiopia's federal government and Tigrayan forces from her hometown in Wollo, Amhara region, where she works as a dancer. With the November peace deal, she is back performing and using her skills to show traditional ways to resolve conflict peacefully between two main ethnic groups, the Amhara and Oromo.
Our only difference is the language. We have seen them rehearsing yesterday, and they have also seen ours. If you look through my family, there's an Oromo, and there's an Amhara in theirs too. I don't know how it got so divided.
The actors in this production demonstrate Abbagar, a customary Amhara way of managing conflict to stop tit-for-tat violence. With Abbagar, elders and women ask for forgiveness on behalf of offenders. Oromo actors perform their traditional Geda system, where the community's women call on elders to resolve conflict using the Sinke stick. The Sinke stick is given from mother to daughter when she gets married to safeguard her rights as a wife. Honoring traditional conflict resolution is key to peace, says artist laureate Yufru Gobena.
This shows the next generation that we can resolve conflict through discussion.
The Ethiopian youth in this audience seem to agree. Mayam Zakir for VOA News, Adama, Ethiopia.
Around the clock, the Voice of America keeps you in touch with the latest news.
Tune in at the top of every hour, every day of the week.
For the 5-minute VOA newscast.
We bring you reports from our correspondents and interviews with newsmakers from around the globe.
Give us 5 minutes and we'll give you the world.
VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com. And check out voaafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition on our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
More than 20,000 people have been killed and tens of thousands injured after a magnitude 7.8 earthquake struck Turkey and Syria on February 6th. The quake hit early in the morning, which meant many people were still in bed, causing them to be trapped under the debris of their homes. Teams are working frantically to aid survivors as aid agencies warn that snow and cold temperatures, as well as a lack of water, communications, and power, may hamper their efforts. Nearly 70,000 people have been injured in Syria and Turkey, according to figures from the Turkish government, the White Helmets, and the media. Speaking at a press conference in Omaniye, Turkey, President Recep Erdogan said 6,444 buildings had collapsed in the earthquake. Teams from more than 24 countries are in Turkey helping local emergency personnel in the rescue and recovery effort. Getting assistance into Syria is more challenging due to the Syrian regime's limits on the movement of aid into the country. The one border crossing that the UN is allowed to use to bring aid from Turkey into northwest Syria was temporarily closed after the earthquake, hindering relief efforts. On February 9th, the United Nations aid convoy was finally able to cross from Turkey into northwest Syria for the first time since the quake. In a recent press conference, Secretary of State Antony Blinken expressed his condolences over the truly staggering, shocking loss of life in Turkey and Syria.
We, I think, along with people around the world, are mourning those who have been lost, and also our thoughts are so with those who have lost loved ones.
Secretary Blinken outlined what the United States is doing to help.
So far, we have deployed more than 150 search and rescue personnel to Turkey. We have U.S. helicopters that are helping to reach areas that would otherwise be difficult to access. In Syria, we have NGO partners that we funded over the years that are providing life-saving assistance to those in need. Across both countries, we've deployed experienced emergency managers, hazardous materials technicians, engineers, logisticians, paramedics, planners, others, along with about 170,000 pounds of specialized tools and equipment.
We are determined, said Secretary Blinken, to do all that we can to help those affected by these earthquakes in the days, weeks, and months ahead.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.